Our 2010 lecturer is A.E. Johnny Johnston, and he will be presenting impact of nitrogen fertilizer on soil organic matter and long-term soil productivity. A very hot topic right now that's receiving much discussion if you've been following the notes in the literature. Now about Johnny Johnston, the reason we wanted him to come and talk about this is he has extensive knowledge of the Rothamsted research plots. He's a Laws Trust Senior Fellow at Rothamsted Research. He started Rothamsted in 1953, the year I was born. And when he retired in 1989 as head of the Soil and Crop Production Division, the Laws Trust honored him with a fellowship which has allowed him to maintain his interest in the many aspects of soil fertility and crop nutrition which have developed throughout his career. In 1994, he received the annual Crop Nutrition Award of the International Fertilizer Industries Association, and he is a past president and council member of the International Fertilizer Society. So Dr. Johnston, could you please come up to the podium and give us your discussion on the impact of nitrogen fertilizer on soil organic matter and long-term soil productivity.
Thank you, Chairman, for that very pleasant introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I certainly feel extremely honored to be here to present this talk to you this afternoon. I want to go back and try and do a little bit of historical build-up as to where we are today, and to remind you that by the time we got to the early 1800s, we were looking upon plant nutrition as being with the mineral elements, as they were called, those elements which were found in plant ash, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, carbon, of course, from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, hydrogen oxide and oxygen from water. Nitrogen, well, there was a great deal of uncertainty about where nitrogen was coming from, although some clearly was coming from the soil. Now, it's very interesting that when Laws did his first experiments at Rothamsted in 1837 and 1838 in small pots and plots, he tested equal amounts of ammonia applied with different anions. So he tested phosphate, sulfate, chloride. And you see in that slide there that the maximum yield was actually given by ammonium phosphate. And that was rather a surprise to him. But he made two very important comments, that applying ammonium salts to a soil deficient in phosphate is useless, and with adequate minerals, ammonia from the atmosphere is insufficient for the needs of a crop. Now, being so keen, of course, on phosphorus, he went ahead with his methodology for producing superphosphate. In 1842, he took out a patent from the government to manufacture superphosphate. In 1843, he had his first factory working at Deptford in London, and there was his first advertisement for his fertilizer. A bit simpler than we get today, of course, from the fertilizer industry, who seem to spend quite a lot of money persuading us that we should use their product. If we go back a couple of years to 1840, Liebig, who was held in very high regard throughout Europe, was asked to prepare a report for the British Association in England, and it was presented at the Glasgow meeting in 1840, and it was entitled Organic Chemistry in its Application to Agriculture and to Physiology. And Liebig made one quite important statement in that cultivated plants receive the same quantity of nitrogen from the atmosphere as trees, shrubs, and other wild plants, but this is not sufficient for the purposes of agriculture. And he also made a very strong statement on the requirement for minerals. So when Broadbalk was started in the winter of 1843, Laws was only tested nitrogen on five of the 20 plots. But very much to his surprise, he found that minerals plus only 14 kilograms of nitrogen gave exactly the same yield of grain as did farmyard manure applied at 35 tonnes per hectare. Clearly, this was something of a surprise to him, but he was very quick to respond, and the following year, he had a range of three rates of nitrogen, and he was showing that the yield increased with that up to 48 kilograms of N per hectare, and his maximum yield was about the same as again he was getting with farmyard manure. It's interesting when you go back through all of the records that Laws and Gilbert never ever said that fertilizers were better than farmyard manure. What they did appreciate, even in the 1840s, that there was no way in which this world could produce enough food to feed people if we relied entirely on organic inputs. And I think that's to me, going back all that time, that's a remarkable statement to have been able to make at that time. Well, what was the effect of this then? If we look at the fertilizer nutrients in use in the UK from 1910 up to 2010, we see that essentially for the first 50 years, there was far more phosphorus used in our agriculture than nitrogen. And as has come out in a number of other papers, we have this vast explosion in nitrogen use from the 1950s for various reasons. Okay, if we go back then a little bit further again into the history of it, we see that although there was only a small increase in the use of nitrogen fertilizer on that graph, we find that Sir William Crookes, in his presidential address to the British Association in 1899, warned of the exhaustion of the world's known reserves of what he then called fixed nitrogen, ammonium salts and sodium salts. But of course, this dire prediction was not realized, and in 1902, Birkeland and Ide in Norway succeeded in combining nitrogen and oxygen to produce calcium nitrate, and in 1910, the Haber-Bosch process came along. And today, of course, it's estimated that about 50% of the world's protein is produced using nitrogen fixed by the Haber-Bosch process. Well, how much we depend on it? Well, is there a reliable way of saying, yes, we do need this nitrogen? Well, these are the grain yields on winter wheat on broadwort from 1844 onwards up to the current time. And we see that this winter wheat has been grown continuously on these same soils, given the same amount of P and K over all that time period. And what has happened over time is that we've changed the cultivar and we've used agrochemicals to protect that yield potential. And so, as I say, on exactly the same plots with the early cultivars of Squares Head Master and Red Rostock, we were only getting a yield of to about 3 tonnes per hectare with 144 kilograms of nitrogen. As soon as we went to the first of the short strawed varieties, Capel de Pré, yield goes up again and we can test up to 192 kilograms of nitrogen. And then we move to the more recent varieties and again we're getting an increase in yield up to about 8 tonnes per hectare. Now that's winter wheat grown continuously year after year, but with changing cultivars and changing protect that yield potential with agrochemicals. Now what is interesting out of that slide, of course, is that when we can grow wheat in rotation, then we do get a much better yield, even at the highest rates of nitrogen. And we get that better yield because in this particular instance, we are removing the adverse effects of soil-borne pathogens. But we must never remember or never forget, and it's coming out these days, of course, in terms of integrated nutrient management, that nitrogen does not work on its own. And so one of the first interactions is between nitrogen and potassium. And why is that important? It's because, of course, to achieve large yields requires a rapid expansion of the leaf canopy. And nitrogen is the major driver of leaf canopy expansion by increasing cell division and cell expansion. More and larger cells means more water in the vacuole. More water in the vacuole means that we need to have potassium there to maintain the cell turgor. So if we look for the barley experiments at two levels of exchangeable K in soil, we see that we get no response to nitrogen unless we have sufficient potassium. We've got exactly the same data for potatoes. When we look at sugar beet, of course, we've got to remember that essentially sugar beet can also use sodium as well as potassium for maintaining turgor, and so we don't get quite the same response. So the difference is not quite so large as it is with spring barley. We've also got to remember that we've got to look at the relationship between nitrogen and phosphorus interactions in soil. And we have two separate experiments here, one on the clay loam soil at Rothamsted and one on a sandy clay loam soil at Saxmundham, where we have built up and developed a range of Olsen P in soil. And these OSMP levels are now pretty well fixed. We're not looking at any interactions or any loss of phosphorus availability from adding fresh phosphate. So these are plots. They take some time to get going, but once you've got them set up, so you've got a range of OSMP levels, then you can test various things. And we're looking at nitrogen in applied here in both cases, and we see that we only get the maximum yield when we have got the most available phosphorus in soil. So two very important interactions leading to this need to think a little bit more carefully of integrated nutrient management. We hear a lot of today too about the efficiency of nitrogen use and how nitrogen is used very inefficiently. But when you start to do some experiments with N15, which are not easy, they're expensive, we see, what do we see? We've got these four different experiments here from a range of experiments which we've had at Rothamsted, which were summarized recently. And we see that essentially, if you look at the recovery of applied N15 in the grain only, it's usually quite small. But when you then add what is in the straw and any other above ground crop, it increases quite considerably. And when you add in what is in remaining in the soil itself and you add the two together, we're looking at recoveries between 80 and 90% of the applied nitrogen. That nitrogen is not being used inefficiently, in my view, in the sense that we can see it and we can recover it. Now, of course, traditionally, the way to look at nitrogen efficiency is to use the difference method, the difference between the uptake of nitrogen by a crop which receives nitrogen and take away the nitrogen which has come from the soil and express that as a percent of the nitrogen which is applied. And if you do that, you see that basically what governs this is the amount of nitrogen which is taken up by the crop that received none. And if you do it that way around, you find that the difference method gives 91, which is very close to our recovery here in the soil. So when we're talking about recoveries of nitrogen, you've got to think about what you're trying to relate it to. We're not just looking at, and we've got to remember how much is coming from the soil. And this last one is really quite an interesting situation because we were getting very high recovery of nitrogen, but this nitrogen was applied to a crop which was grown on a soil very high in organic matter, which had been receiving farmyard manure for many years. And we find that the nitrogen fertilizer, if we look at it by a difference method, because that yield is almost the same as the yield with the applied nitrogen, by the difference method, we're only getting 40% recovery. But by the N15 method, we're getting an over 80% recovery. And this is a very, this seems to me to be very interesting because it's suggesting for some reason the crop is preferring to use the nitrogen which has been applied as fertilizer rather than the nitrogen which is there in the soil. I can't offer you any explanation, but it seems to me to be extremely and very interesting explanation, and it's happening on the broad-bought winter wheat experiment too. Now if we come back to soil organic matter, soil organic matter tends to be the one index of soil quality which everybody is using today. If you want a single index of soil quality, everybody says we look at soil organic matter. Now, we'd had some very bad harvests in Britain in the late 1960s, and there was a lot of discussion about how much organic matter should there be in soil. And Walter Russell, who was the son of our past director, in 1977 wrote a very interesting paper which was published. And I just bit out two or three little bits. It has long been suspected by farmers that the humus in soil is important. And of course, the soils which have got most humus are black compared to soils which have got little humus, which are much paler in colour. Black soils invariably produced larger yields in that historical period. And so, as he said, good farmers have always had as one of their goals of good management the raising of the humus content of their soils. But then he raises the most important point, but present-day economic factors have forced many farmers to adopt practices which cause the humus content of their soils to fall. And then the major problem facing us as the research community is to quantify the effects of soil organic matter on the complex of properties which he put together. He used that very old-fashioned word, English word, subsumed, much under the phrase of soil fertility. Well, what is soil organic matter? We had an experiment on our farm at Woburn, which is a light sandy soil, 10% of clay. And in 1940, we were interested to see how quickly they could raise the organic matter. So they tested four different organic manures: a vegetable compost, biosolids and straw compost, and a vegetable compost. And you see that they have very different carbon-nitrogen ratios, 13 to 1, 14 to 1, 9 and 12. But after 25 years in the soil, the soil carbon-nitrogen ratio was 10 to 1 to 11 to 1. So the carbon-nitrogen ratios had changed appreciably. And if you plotted the increase in soil organic carbon against the amount of organic material applied, they fell entirely on a straight line. It didn't matter what form you'd added the organic matter in, it was staying there. Now, in 1961, we were discovering that we were adding so much heavy metals in the biosolids that it was decided that those treatments should stop. So that stopped in 1961. 5 years later, we stopped the farmyard manure treatments, and the soils were now having no further input of organic matter, but the levels of organic matter were allowed to decline. Now, because it had started at different dates, because they had started from different levels of organic matter in the soil, we got different decay curves. But sitting in the lab, when one has a little bit of opportunity to sit and do a bit of thinking — I'm not sure how many of us these days get an opportunity to do a bit of thinking — but it became pretty obvious that if we looked at those response curves and shifted them, they would all come on a unified decay curve. And having some good friends in the statistics department, they did that for us, and these decay curves, if I've lost the mouse, are all on the same uniform curve. So in other words, it looks very much as though the organic matter in soil is a very uniform composition, no matter what we apply to it. So what about the amount of organic matter in soil? It depends then on the input of organic material and its rate of decomposition, the rate of decomposition of existing soil organic matter, soil texture, and climate. And all four factors interact so that the level of soil organic matter changes towards an equilibrium level specific to the soil type and farming system. And I want us to remember that we're talking about declining to an equilibrium level. And in general, the equilibrium level of soil organic matter for a cropping system will be larger on a clay soil than on a sandy soil, and that for a given soil, it will be larger with permanent grass than with continuous arable cropping. And we can look at some of those effects. David Jenkinson, many years ago, made some gruesome ryegrass in growth chambers, labeled the ryegrass with C14. He was working with Ann Arbor in Nigeria at the time. The samples of ryegrass were sent out there. They were kept at home. They were mixed with soil. They were put in the soil, in containers in the soil, so they were subject to local soil temperatures. And we find that the decay curve, the disappearance of the C14 from both sites, fell on exactly the same curve. But if you look at the top axis, that's 10 years for Rothamsted, 2.5 years for Nigeria. So the rate of decomposition is affected solely by temperature. If we now look at the effect of soil texture, we've got our soil at Rothamsted, which is a silty clay loam. We have our soil at Woburn, which is a sandy loam. This is growing barley continuously. This is growing mainly cereals with an occasional root crop in. And you see that essentially we are getting from a level here of about, 30 tonnes per hectare. Soil organic matter fell a little bit to begin with, and then has remained remarkably constant over the last 100 odd years. It started at a much higher level on the sandy loam soil at Woburn, but it has fallen to a level which is now below that at Rothamsted. So both sets of soil are moving towards an equilibrium value, and soil texture plays an important point in that. If we now look at soil organic matter and farming system, this is an experiment which was started way back in 1937 on the sandy loam soil at Woburn, so it's now been going for 60 odd years. And we have got three treatments. Essentially, a soil which we've fallowed. There is a 5-year rotation. The crops are either grown for 5 arable crops, or we have a 3 years, what we call a lay arable, 3 years of a grass lay of some description, followed by 2 arable crops. Now, for reasons which we wanted to look at the effect of soil-borne diseases, some of these plots were kept permanently permanently fallowed, and soil organic matter has fallen very slowly. Where we have been growing a crop, an arable crop, in all of the period of 5 years, the values are slightly higher. And I'd like you to remember that we have got a difference there, that both curves follow the same sort of pattern. This is the increase in soil organic matter on a soil which has 3 years of grass lay given nitrogen fertilizer. For the begin with, it's reached a new equilibrium level, and since then, the equilibrium level has been maintained. In other words, all the organic matter which we build up under the lay in 3 years is being lost essentially when we have the land ploughed to grow arable crops for 2 years. To me, that says something about where do we stand with organic farming systems when they talk about lays building soil fertility. It's a very temporary affair, in my view. And I think this is perhaps also one of the interesting lines, the orange one. Here you see that there was no increase in soil organic matter, and this was where we grew 3 years of lucerne, or alfalfa, I think, over here. And then, because we had problems with root diseases on the lucerne, we chopped it off, we started to grow a grass lay with clover. It's increased in soil organic matter because we've changed the farming system. We've changed the farming system, and it's now reached an equilibrium value, which I think that'll now begin to level off in the next 5 or 10 years, an equilibrium value very similar to that. What happens then if we have a soil organic matter and a change in the farming system? We have a lay arable experiment at Rothamsted, which was done on 2 separate sites, one which was in old grassland when we started, one which was in permanent arable when we started. Improve your grass management and you increase the organic matter. Plough the grass up and grow arable crops and it gradually declines. And it's been declining, you will see, over nearly 60 odd years. Leave your permanent arable soil in permanent arable and it's at its equilibrium level and it stays there. Take your permanent arable soil and put it down to permanent grass and it gradually increases, but yet it hasn't got as high as it has on the permanent grass plots on the Highfield experiment. How long then will it take us to increase soil organic matter in soil? Well, these are some sites at Rothamsted. Again, this is all on the same soil. I'm not using data from different sites, which might in some way be confounded. And we know that we've got about 0.15% of this is total nitrogen now in the soil of our arable soils. It goes up to about just under 3 on our permanent grassland soils. And you see it's taken 100 years to go from the organic matter level, equilibrium level, of a soil which is in permanent arable to a soil which is in permanent grass. You might ask, well, how have I got values out there for 300 years? It's simply because the park grass experiment at Rothamsted, which started in 1856, Laws found that that site had been in a permanent grassland for at least 200 years before. So I'm almost that age, but not quite that age. But so quite clearly, we have kept the level of soil organic matter. It's reached its new equilibrium level. We've also built it up. We had a site at Rothamsted which was put down to permanent woodland in 1871. And the soil organic matter there, we haven't as many points because it's never sampled as frequently, but it's slowly accumulating organic matter and it's not yet reached its new equilibrium level. I've actually just put on there, we had a plot adjacent to the lay arable experiment which had been in permanent grass, which was ploughed in 1949. It's been kept fallow ever since, and you can see just how quickly soil organic matter falls when you are keeping the land permanently fallow. But even that fall has taken something like 40 years to get down there. Changes in soil organic matter in temperate climates are very, very slow. However, discussing things in terms of equilibrium levels does have one major problem. Because if you reach an equilibrium level, it means that what you're putting in is being matched by what is coming out of the system. And that's just a simple curve to show what is happening on our farmyard manure plots on the long-term experiments compared to what is happening on the nil plots. It is building up quickly. But if you now look at the different periods, you see a very different story emerge, or a very important story emerging. We're adding that amount of nitrogen in the farmyard manure each year. We know that we've got some input of nitrogen from the atmosphere, which has been growing up, as seems to have steadied in recent times. We know, because we've harvested all the crops, exactly how much nitrogen was in the crop at each of these periods of time. It was gradually increasing because we were getting bigger and bigger yields. We know what the increase in soil nitrogen was, very quick there, slower and slower and slower now. And when we now look at the nitrogen which is not accounted for in this system, we found that it's more initially up to 100 kilograms of N per hectare per year. It's now nearly, because we're nearly at equilibrium, it's nearly 200 kilograms of N per hectare. The same thing will happen with carbon, but of course we don't have carbon data because it's more difficult to measure where the losses are going. So equilibrium, fine, but it has problems. Input is matched by output. What's the effect of soil organic matter and its interaction with nitrogen fertilisers? These are the yields on the Housefield barley experiment. And you can see if we go to a cultivar in 1976, a cultivar called Julia, we could in fact get exactly the same yield with fertilisers as we were with soils which were getting 35 tonnes of farmyard manure each year. We then went to a crop with a higher yield potential and they're beginning to separate these response curves. We then go to a very high yielding potential cultivar and we've got a big separation. Now, the important thing I think to notice is that on the fertilizer plots, yield has not gone down as we've changed our cultivars. We're not getting an adverse effect of putting nitrogen fertilizer on those plots. What we are getting is that the better soil structure, where there is more organic matter, then that crop is responding, that soil is responding in a way that the newer cultivars are growing very well and giving a very big increase in yield. And we can see the same thing happening on our sandy soil at Woburn. We were growing potatoes, spring barley, winter wheat and winter barley. If you look now at the nitrogen rates, on the soil with low organic matter and the soil with high organic matter, then there's for potatoes a spring sown crop, for spring barley a spring sown crop. We never get the same yield as with the nitrogen fertilizer we apply on the soil with low organic matter than the one with higher organic matter. Where we're growing winter wheat crops and or winter sown cereals, we do get exactly the same yield, largely I suspect because those crops do make a good root system in which to grow. Soil organic matter then and crop responds to phosphorus. Well, these are some response curves for yields of potatoes against Olson P on two soils in exactly the same experiment where we had made these the differences in organic matter. And you can see that the yields are essentially the same at 98.5% of the maximum yield which was achieved. But the Olson P which was required to achieve that was vastly different between the soil with more organic matter than the soil with less organic matter in all three examples. Now, having done that experiment, the soils were all sampled, they were brought into the laboratory, we had a pot experiment with ryegrass, and then we find that organic matter has no effect. In other words, exactly the same yield as here, but the levels of Olson P required to achieve that was the same, and the percentage variance accounted for was essentially the same. So I interpret that as saying that essentially what is happening in the field is on a soil which is low in organic matter, then you get very poor root growth and consequently you get very poor and very inefficient use of the nutrients that you've applied. Now let's come to then to some of these current issues. There have been three recent papers that have suggested that soil organic matter is declining and it is implied that this is due to the use of nitrogen fertilisers. We've had one in England in 2005 with the headline, carbon losses from all soils across England and Wales. We had another one 2 years later in J.A. Environmental Quality, the myth of nitrogen fertilisation on carbon sequestration. And the third one, an even bigger banner headline, synthetic nitrogen fertilisers deplete soil nitrogen, a global dilemma, sustainable for sustainable cereal production. You know, where do we come from? But really, what is so frightening in my view is that none of those three papers mention the word equilibrium level of soil organic matter, and that is what is driving this system. Not one of those three papers mentions equilibrium levels. And none of them reckon, of course, either of the timescale of change. Now, if I look at that first paper from England, if you look at the data very closely, it was done from a survey of a national survey of soil samples, which was sampled something like 25 years ago on a 5 kilometre grid across all of the soils in England and Wales. So they were sampled then, and they were sampled again between 12 and 25 years later, and they've used that data set. And we found, if you look at that data closely and you look at the soils in eastern England, which is our major arable area, you find that the changes are very small because the soils in the east of England have been growing arable crops for the last 100-odd years, and the soils are at their equilibrium level. If you look at the soils where there have been changes, there are soils which are in permanent grassland, which have been ploughed and following the war to grow more arable crops, and those soils are not yet at their equilibrium level. They're gradually falling to it. Now, how do we use long-term time series of experiments? And I would suggest we have to use them in two ways. We will have time, we will have treatment, and we ought to be able to put perhaps some factor, some measure into each of these boxes. Now, there's three ways that you can look at that data. You can say, okay, we've got exactly the same fall, but the falls are not the same. We've got the same build-up, but the build-up is greater in various periods. We have a situation in which the changes in values are random. Now, the author of that last paper, in condemning one of the members of his own department, but not in the same little group, says that this is a cardinal sin to use comparisons at any one time. Now, I would agree that it is wrong because you don't know whether you've got your change there or your change there. But if you've got two sets of data and they're both changing in the same way, whether they're declining or they're increasing, it is, to me, absolutely valid to be able to make that comparison at one point in time, as long as you know it's all changing in the right direction. And so we're slated in these two papers with a lot of data which is taken from the literature. And I'm just going to use two of them because they're from the experiments I know. These are the changes in the total nitrogen on the plots on broadbore over the period of time. And yes, here we start at a high value. And what the author of that third paper said was that, okay, it's gone down. And this is due to nitrogen fertilizers. It's nothing of the sort, quite frankly. Why do we start at that value? We start at that value because in the past, those soils were in a Norfolk four-course rotation, where the weeds were ploughed in every year, where there was an occasional dressing of farmyard manure, perhaps as much as 10 tonnes per acre or 25 tonnes per hectare every 4 or 5 years. So we're seeing not what is happening now, but we're seeing what is happening now is a result of what was happening in the past. So we have this high value here, and it's gone down now because we are now growing cereals continuously rather than growing arable crops in rotation, and because we're putting no farmyard manure on, and because Laws and Gilbert are making sure that every little weed that grows is hacked out of by using labour, hand labour to do it because labour was cheap. So we've got a totally different system, and therefore organic matter levels fell originally. They got very bad here because we had a big weed infestation. They seem to have improved a little bit. put P and K on, then essentially you get a slightly higher yield because of the extra amount of crop which is being produced. But there is a slight crossover there. But I think when you're looking at the level of the change, it's very small. Here is the plot that gets NP and K fertilizers, and I can see no effect there that nitrogen fertilizers have decreased the organic matter level in the soils. We have a plot here which for a number of years got a lower level of nitrogen, and it went through with that low level of nitrogen, only 48 kilograms of N per hectare. To increase the range, we put it up to 196 kilograms per N per hectare here. And all of a sudden, we're increasing soil organic matter. We're applying a lot of nitrogen, but we're not decreasing soil organic matter. We're actually increasing it. If I go now to what is happening on the changes in total nitrogen on the plots on Hoosefield, started in 1852, again, we see that we start with a high value and it all comes down. But why? It was a system that was in the Norfolk four-course rotation. It got weeds, it got farmyard manure. As soon as you change the system to one of continuous cereals, where you're making sure you've got no weeds, then your organic matter is going to fall. It's bound to fall. If you just look at that little bit of data there, If you look at that little bit of data there, you might say, well, there's the plot that gets nitrogen fertilizer. It's gone down below the unmanured. Nothing of the well, that's true. But what is the reason? It's not because of putting, it's not directly the effect of putting nitrogen fertilizer on. It's because the nitrogen fertilizer went on as ammonium sulfate. Ammonium sulfate acidified the soil, make the soil so acid that it won't grow spring barley. Spring barley has no input, therefore, of organic matter, and therefore the organic matter level in the soil falls. It's a case, as I said at the top, you look at the figure, but for goodness sake, please read the text. Because if you don't read the text and explain what's there, you've got no indication of what is really happening. What is interesting here too is that we've, because of controlling equisetum, all these plots, we don't have a specific nitrogen-only plot now. The plot nitrogen rates are rotated. And starting off from their individual values, they're all falling a little bit more now because the yields are not as large as they were there. So, as I say, all three papers have failed to recognize that organic matter reaches an equilibrium level. And I really put to you, why is there so little recognition of the importance of the equilibrium level of soil organic matter? Is it we don't teach it? Is it because we don't understand it? Is it because we've got no truck with it? I don't know. But it seems to me that because soil organic matter plays such a pivotal role in soil fertility and crop production, we ought to be making sure that people understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. Now, will this current controversy be resolved? I'm not sure it will. But there's certain similarities with the controversy between Laws and Gilbert and Liebig 160-odd years ago. And that very first slide, near the beginning, I showed you the first statement that Liebig had made, and where he put, but this is not sufficient, talking about nitrogen for the purposes of agriculture. 2 years later, he changed that sentence and said that this nitrogen is quite sufficient for the purposes of agriculture. So diametrically opposed. Now it's interesting, of course, that Laws and there was then an argument between Laws and Gilbert at Rothamsted and Liebig in Germany for the next 20 odd years. They argued backward and forward in the scientific literature. They really said a few unkind things about one another in the scientific literature and in the private things. Laws and Gilbert based their view on the increasing evidence from their field experiments, that it was essential to apply a supplementary dressing of nitrogen to supplement that from the soil. Now, Liebig eventually gave way, and if you remember what we said on that very first slide, that we'd talked about minerals, and we had a little section which said nitrogen at home. Liebig eventually gave way and saying that he had always considered that nitrogen was a mineral nutrient, just like phosphorus and potassium, and it had to be added to the soil. Now, that, as I say, this argument went on for 20-odd years. Now, this is quite interesting that if you look in the archive at Rothamsted, you see that after about 5 or 6 years of their experiments, which were costing Laws at that time something like £6,000 a year to run. And it was out of his own money. It was okay, it was coming from the profits of his business, but he was out of his own money. It wasn't, there was no government grants or grants from the fertilizer industry. He was doing it himself. And he decided, I think, that he was so convinced that his results were right that he was going to stop these experiments. But then I think he must have stopped to think. Liebig was so wily, so controversial, that I'm quite convinced that he would have turned around and said, if you stop them, you've stopped them because you're not putting on your minerals and your nitrogen is killing them. And so fortunately, he kept the experiments going. Fortunately, today, we still have them. So today, there are the yields on Broadwalk from 1856 to 2005. There's no indication whatsoever that nitrogen fertilizers have caused a problem. There's our own manure at the bottom, trickling along. Here's our winter wheat grown continuously, and we see that these are the various stages that we had to introduce fallowing to control weeds before we had herbicides, to put on liming to ensure the pH stayed right, the introduction of herbicides, and later of fungicides. Here are the changes in varieties. We've gone throughout the period with changing the variety to the one that's most commonly grown and has a high yield potential. And so when we're growing our wheat either continuously or as a first wheat in rotation, we get exactly the same yield with fertilizers as we do with farmyard manure. Fertilizers have not caused a problem. So what is the conclusion? I think the conclusion would be this. And let's take out that first phrase of that last title of that paper. Take out the phrase, synthetic nitrogen fertilizers deplete soil nitrogen. Let's leave in the second phrase, a global dilemma for sustainable production, and let's add, will occur when there is no nitrogen fertilizer. And remember that we apply that to every crop that we grow for food to feed an expanding world population. A global dilemma for food production in a sustainable way will occur when there is no longer any nitrogen fertilizer to feed those crops. So a few acknowledgements. First to SSA for the invitation and support to come and present this lecture. And then especially to all those worldwide who had the foresight to start long-term experiments so that today we have insights into the many aspects of soil fertility and crop production. To the countless researchers, assistants, and farm staff, whose dedication to long-term experiments worldwide over many, many years has made them a valuable resource, which we should never underestimate. To colleagues at Rothamsted for fruitful discussion, and particularly to Paul Poulton, with whom I've worked for many years. To Don Sparks for accepting, and to Advances in Agronomy for publishing a very long review which has discussed the work of 150 years on our at Rothamsted. So there I rest my case, Chairman, but I would rather than like to leave a blank screen, just like to leave four comments for you to think about as you think about what you might or might not wish to ask. Thank you, Chairman, indeed.
Can we envision a way in which we either continue the soil organic matter increase along high organic matter systems that do not have those high levels of loss?
Because your equilibrium level depends really on your inputs. You can, in that Woburn Market Garden experiment, we were putting on 37 and 75 tons of fresh material per hectare per year. So you got obviously the biggest increase where you put on most. But to maintain that increase, you've got to go on putting that input. And to be rather cheeky, that's why the last of those comments on the slide is, if we're going for carbon trading, who will monitor when soils reach their equilibrium level and there's going to be no more increase in carbon? You know, this is we lend ourselves into trouble sometimes. But no, the only way that you can manage it is to say, if you put land down to permanent forestry, then obviously you get the carbon captured in the above ground biomass and you get carbon captured in the below ground biomass. But from what is happening at Rothamsted, where those forestry went onto that old arable land, in 1871, we're approaching the maximum amount we're going to get into the soil. Now, you could deplete it by, if you went into conventional ploughing, you can, of course, turn it all over, and then you'll get some going to depth. But I see it as one of the problems of min-till, whichever way you practice min-till, that essentially you're going to reach an equilibrium level in the soil which you till, which may be 4, 5, or 6 inches. When that's reached equilibrium, unless somebody's going down in root mass, you're going to reach an equilibrium more quickly in a min-till situation than you will in a conventional ploughing situation. And I think this is, you know, something that we don't always consider. We just, I think, make the assumption that it goes into the soil, it stays in the soil, and it'll move down the soil. And I don't think that is true of organic matter.
So you showed 200 years of carbon change in soils. How do you account for analytical differences that have occurred over those 200 years?
Well, we are very fortunate at Rothamsted that we have an archive of soils which goes back to the beginning of those experiments. So soils are, at the moment, the broadbalk soils have all been resampled and reanalyzed. And so, yes, we were having problems. We started off, of course, using Walkley Black, and then we went on to Tinsley, then we're now on Alico. And to get over that very problem, we've just been resampling all the broadbalk soils and reanalyzing the essential treatments, not all of them.
This morning you were talking about the importance of soil texture and the soil structure for root growth. How does that impact with the organic matter changes and things as we look at growing plants?
The soils with low levels of organic matter, if you really can look at them in relation to yield, have also always got the lowest yields in those experiments that we've had, and you get a small response to nitrogen from spring sown crops when you have that low level of organic matter. As I think I said this morning, and I think I very strongly believe, that the more input we've done, essentially, if you like to go through it, we started off with nutrition in the 1800s, mid-1800s, and we know a little bit about nutrition. We started on with pathology, particularly cereal pathology, in the 1920s, 1930s, and we think we know a little bit about pathology. We know extremely little about soil structure, and part of that is the problem that we have no analytical method to be able to go back and look at changes in soil structure with no analytical method that we can use in the lab. And I think this is the major problem. This is the next breakthrough. Somebody who will come up and, well, do two things. How do we define soil structure? Well, as to me, the only way we can define soil structure is in relation to the crop growth that we get. And whether there'll ever be a lab method, but I can't imagine, really, at the moment, envisage a lab method where you would go out and sample the soil and bring it in and say, this has got a structure X, Y, or Z, and you can categorize it in the same way that currently we can do for P and K, and for nitrogen, of course.
Yes. In your one of your slides, you compared Rothamsted and Nigerian.
Yep.
And you concluded that the difference was only the temperature, but did you mean include rainfall also?
Oh yeah, the soils were incubated at constant moisture in both situations. It was only the temperature that was different. And they were incubated, as I say, pots were put into the soil for the incubation to happen at the soil temperature adjacent to them.
So do you think that the ratio of N in the plant of fertilizer crops being N derived from the soil and N derived from the fertilizer has been constant for the last 100 years?
No, I don't think it has, because the percentage recovery of applied nitrogen has increased. So I think I'd want further notice of that to go back and check it properly, but I don't think that the ratio has changed at all. It's to improve the nitrogen uptake from the fertilizer, partly because in these very long-term experiments where you've got plots where you've never put any fertilizer on, any nitrogen fertilizer on, your yields are small, your organic matter levels are small, and therefore the nitrogen which is coming out of that organic matter is minute. I mean, if you look at the whole change of over time and do a little bit of averaging for short periods, the amount of nitrogen which we get from the soil until we had that has been remarkably constant across winter wheat, grain and straw, spring barley, grain and straw, potatoes and sugar beet at about 30 kilograms of N per hectare until we got these rather large increases coming in from the atmosphere. And as I showed on those, that input, in the early 1990s, we were talking about 45 kilograms coming in the atmosphere. Now we're back to about 30. So, yes, I think essentially the uptake from the soil nitrogen has remained remarkably constant. The rest of the uptake has come from the applied fertilizer.
We have a small gift for Dr. Johnston, and I know you'll want to join me in thanking him one more time. We have a plaque that says the Soil Science Society of America recognizes A.E. Johnny Johnston as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2010 Leo M. Walsh Soil Fertility Distinguished Lectureship funded through the Agronomic Science Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the Society, as I say, for their interest to and their invitation. I have very much enjoyed being with you, and I do thank you for having me here. Thank you.